Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you go to the events page. Registration is now open for the Here We Still Stand National Conference in San Diego, California. You want to come hang out with Chad Bird. You want to hang out with me. You want to hang out with all the 1517 people and a whole bunch of your friends in October in sunny, gorgeous San Diego, California. There's a link in the show notes, or you can go over to 1517.org, find that event, and you can register today. Chad, big day, starting, well, new book, kind of. It's in the Bible, it's a new book. It is the second book of Kings, or the second half of Kings is probably a more appropriate way to say it. And it's going to pick up right where the other one left off. This isn't like, you know, when you're reading a series and a book ends and then you pick up another book and it starts, you know, by painting some scene and you're waiting for maybe some familiar characters to show up. This is just right back into it. This reads like just the next chapter.
Yeah. Just like they got to the end of writing 1 Kings and they were like, man, this scroll is getting long.
Yeah.
And we're only like halfway. I tell you what, let's just stop it here. Grab another scroll and we'll start writing on it. And I mean that it's actually not a caricature. That's pretty much probably what happened. You know, back then these were practical concerns. These scrolls were big, and so once it got to a certain length, then you're either going to be dealing with a huge scroll or you just grab another one. I'm pretty sure that's why Luke and Acts are two different volumes. Because if he had tried to put it on one scroll, it would have been too big. So yeah, this is just kind of taking a practical approach, cutting it in half. And so we start with not what would sound like the opening of a book. It says in verse 1, after the death of Ahab, Moab rebelled against Israel. So we just kind of jump right back into the story. So Ahab, of course, we've heard a lot about over these last few chapters, along with Elijah, who was, of course, his chief nemesis. Prophet against king. And in the last chapter of 1 Kings, Ahab dies, and then he is replaced by his son, Ahaziah. Now we're going to hear more about him in just a minute. In fact, he's going to be the focus of this first chapter. But we start out by hearing about Moab. Now, this is really nothing is made of this at this point. It's going to be picked up again, I think, in 2 Kings 3. We're going to hear more about the rebellion of Moab. But this helps to kind of position it historically, know what was going on elsewhere. And there may be, some commentators think there may be a hint here that before this, Moab, a Gentile nation, was controlled. And then with the death of Ahab, this powerful king, then the Moabites rebelled, which, of course, would not be unusual. This happens a lot of times. If you have a vassal kingdom, they see that the king who was over them dies. Well, they take advantage of that opportunity to rebel because you got confusion between the death of one king, the replacement of another, and who knows if the replacement king is going to be as strong and authoritative and powerful as the one who preceded him. So Moab basically takes advantage of the situation to rebel against Israel and try and achieve their independence. So that's the way it starts out, verse 1, and then it immediately shifts to Ahab's son, Ahaziah. And we'll find out, number one, what happened to him, number two, what he tried to do about it, and then number three, how God's prophet Elijah stood in his way. So it starts out, verse 2, by telling us about the situation. Ahaziah, we're told, fell through the lattice in his upper chamber in Samaria and lay sick. Probably what happened here is he fell out of a window. The Hebrew here is a little bit ambiguous. The word translated as lattice, some of the dictionaries put like a window lattice, and that kind of makes sense since this was something that happened in his upper chamber in Samaria. So he's got a multi-level house. For some reason, who knows why, we're not told, he falls through, no doubt injures himself in some way, and now he's sick. He's sick in bed. So you're sick in bed, what are you going to do? Well, probably, of course, they consulted the physicians, but evidently it was bad enough to where they thought they needed to consult a divine oracle to find out what's going to happen. So that's the way the story continues. After he falls through, he's sick. He sends messengers. And here's what he told them. He said, go inquire of Beelzebub, or Baal-Zebub, however you want to pronounce that. Beelzebub, I guess, is the way we say this in English. Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, whether I shall recover from this sickness. So we'll talk more about that name and kind of the significance of this in a minute. But one thing that's, I think, worthy of note right away is, you know, the northern kingdom, as we've seen throughout 1 Kings, started out badly. It started out with Jeroboam right away, fearing his people would go to the temple in Jerusalem, rebel against him. And so he established the golden calves at Dan and Bethel, the northern and southern perimeters of his kingdom, and said, hey, that's where you can go to worship. So Jeroboam, obviously a bad guy, an idolater. However, Jeroboam, at least when his son became ill, wanted to consult the prophet. And so he makes his wife dress up, disguise herself to go inquire the prophet of Yahweh. That's the prophet that he was going to. Now, here we see a few generations later, Ahaziah is not even worried about finding the true prophet. In fact, he is going to go outside the borders of Israel and consult with a foreign god, the god of Ekron, Ekron being one of the Philistine cities. So I point this out because it's like things have gone from bad to worse, in other words. Bad enough with Jeroboam, and now they're wanting to consult someone outside the borders of Israel and a god other than Yahweh.
Isn't that kind of how this works, too? Like, if you're in your own life, even, if you feel like you're far from God, or you've done a bunch of things that have displeased God, or you have not been concerned about God, then something happens, you will find some other way to find comfort or get an answer. You'd be like, well, me and God are not on speaking terms right now. He's probably very irritated with me. It makes sense that you would, in a moment, what you would like to see is in a moment, in a dire moment, maybe you come back to your senses, right? You like do some prodigal son stuff, and you come. It could read that he lay sick in his bed and came to his senses and said, "Go find a prophet of Yahweh," and maybe this could be a great thing, and that would be better. But he doesn't, because him and Yahweh are not in relationship.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when you were talking, I was thinking back to my own life, and I won't share the details, but yeah, sometimes when, man, I was convinced that number one, God didn't want anything to do with me, and that I was I'd made him mad so many times that when it came for answers, I wasn't talking to him. I was not consulting Yahweh. I was going to the god of Ekron.
Yeah.
I was going somewhere else. Thankfully, in my case, over time, God brought me to the point of repentance and seeking him. But what you say is very true. I mean, the more you go down the road of idolatry and rebellion, then the more you tend to inquire of the god of Ekron or the god of whatever it might be. And I was, since we're on this topic, I was going to bring this up in a minute. We can talk about it now. It is kind of interesting, too, how kind of the modern versions of this, too, both in our individual lives, like we've been talking about, but also in the church. You know, in a minute, we're going to hear this line from Elijah. He says, is it because there's no God in Israel that you're going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? So it's like we are always looking for idols, if you will, people to consult. Oftentimes, when God has actually given us the answer. You know, so he's told us A, and for whatever reason, we don't like A, and so we go and consult someone to say, you know, find out maybe they're going to say B or C or D. But if God has given us a clear word on something, well, then no more inquiries really need to be made, because we've been told exactly what God wishes us to know. There is kind of this this cultural tendency to want to almost idolize experts, I guess is what I'm saying. Mm-hmm. You know, and certainly I'm not downplaying the importance of experts. But if God has told us that which is true, that which we should do, well, then if an expert says something contrary to that, well, then it's pretty obvious who we should listen to.
Oh, and sometimes we're prone to going and finding an expert who we believe is going to tell us the thing that we want to hear.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So if you're wanting a word from a God and you're concerned that maybe the God of Israel is not going to give you that word, maybe you go ask a different God that you're like, I think this God might have. And you know what's usually happens in these situations is you'll go and ask the false God, will I recover? And he'll say something like, you will recover if you do this thing. And is there a prescription? Like, you're actually looking for a prescription. Do I need to do these things? Do I need to sacrifice 12, you know, bulls? What do I need to do? Like, what do I need to do to recover from this sickness? And Yahweh probably not going to give you that. He's probably just going to tell you yes or no.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that is the way of all the gods of the world. They're all quid pro quo gods, mm-hmm. right? They all work with transactionalism. That's the way all the idols of the world are. If you want something from an idol, then the idol demands that you give him something first. And so you give him the gift, he gives you something in return. And I mean, that is the way the world works. No free lunches, right? So we translate that into the theological realm all the time. And we do this with idols, and we try and do this with God, of course, as well, you know, thinking, if I give up this, then God will love me. Or if I do this, then God will be pleased with me. That's certainly the way that idols work, but that's not the way that God works, because he loved us before we did anything good or bad. It's the whole Jacob and Esau thing, right? That's the way that God works. He doesn't work with quid pro quo. Back to the name itself. This is kind of fascinating history here. So the name itself of this god of Ekron, Beelzebub, there's a couple of different ways that this is sometimes explained. I mean, we're all familiar with Baal. We've heard a lot about Baal. This is probably a case where it's kind of a local manifestation of the god Baal. This happened with other gods as well. So it's Baal, but it's like he was maybe... there was supposedly some manifestation of him at Ekron, and so he got this name Beelzebub. So what exactly does it mean? Well, literally, the Zebub part means flies. In fact, this is where they get the title of the famous novel, Lord of the Flies. So Beelzebub means Lord of the Flies. Now, is this meant to be taken literally? Like some scholars will argue that, well, you know, he was like a god of the plagues of insects, or maybe he was represented under the icon of a fly. But that's a minority opinion. Most people think that this is a case, like plenty of other cases in the Old Testament, where the name was deliberately changed, deliberately altered, in order to make fun of the deity. Now, the most common way this happens is names that were originally Baal were changed in Hebrew to Boshet, which means shame. So a person, I think, was it Saul's son that was named Ish-Baal, but most of the time he's called Ish-Boshet. So instead of man of Baal, his name is changed deliberately, making fun of it, to man of shame. So most scholars think that Beelzebub originally was Beelzebul, Z-E-B-U-L, which would mean Baal the prince. So they altered it from Z-E-B-U-L, Zebul, to Zebub. So instead of it being Baal the prince, it becomes Baal of the Flies, or Lord of the Flies. Now, that's just kind of interesting if you like words. But I think what's most interesting to me is how over time, when we get to the Gospels, mm-hmm. Beelzebub really is no longer viewed in light of this background, but instead that name is understood as another name for the prince of demons, for Satan himself. Of course, you have this famous accusation that the scribes, the Pharisees, or whoever it is, level against Jesus. You know, it's by Beelzebub that you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he cast out a demon. I think this is in Matthew 10. And Jesus casts out a demon, and the Pharisees say it is by the power of Beelzebub, or the prince of demons, that he casts out demons. So they use this as an insult, an accusation against Jesus, to say, like, well, the reason the demons listen to you is because you are the prince of demons, you're the lord of demons, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so in essence, kind of accusing Jesus of being a modern Ahaziah, right? Mm. Like he's looks just like Ahaziah was going to inquire of Beelzebub. So, well, Jesus is in league with Beelzebub, and so that's the reason he has his power. It seems to me what's going on with this transference of names from a particular Philistine deity in the Old Testament to now being the name of the prince of demons is that the name change itself is really not much of a change, in this sense that the power behind the dark reality behind all of these idols, including Beelzebub, has always been the devil.
Right.
It's the same thing that Paul says in 1 Corinthians, where he talks about those who sacrifice to idols, they sacrifice to demons. So the true power, in other words, behind the idols are the demonic forces. But also, and that is evident with this name being applied later to Satan himself.
It also seems very unlikely that Jesus is doing anything by the power of Beelzebub, or is Beelzebub, when he's about to show up.
Yes, right. Yeah, he's about to show up here in 2 Kings chapter 1. Interesting connection then back to Matthew 10, right?
Yeah.
Where we have the name, and then all of a sudden Jesus shows up. And then Matthew 10, you have Jesus being there and falsely accused with this particular name. So verse 3 is where we have this. It says the Moloch, which in ESV and almost every English translation is translated as angel, but it's messenger. The messenger of Yahweh said to Elijah the Tishbite.
Not to be confused. Another occasion. Not to be confused with a messenger from Yahweh.
Yes, not to be confused with a messenger, but this is the Moloch, the messenger, the one who bears the word of the Father, right? So this is another Christ appearance, another Christophany in the Old Testament. This isn't the first time that Jesus has paid a visit to Elijah. We saw other occasions, especially when he fled from Jezebel. He hightailed it down to Mount Sinai. Jesus met him in the wilderness, took care of him, fed him, and then appeared to him again there at Mount Sinai. Another contrast, I suppose you could say, is that you can't see in the English, and that is that, so Ahaziah sends Malachim, he sends messengers, telling them to go inquire of this Philistine god, but then the messenger of the Lord shows up. So this is, I can't remember the context, we've seen this before, though, where a king sends human messengers, and then all of a sudden the messenger of God shows up with the truth. So Jesus says to Elijah, the messenger of Yahweh says to Elijah the Tishbite, arise, go up to meet the messengers of the king of Samaria, and say to them, is it because there is no God in Israel that you're going to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron? Now therefore, thus says Yahweh, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. And so Elijah went. So that's the message, basically saying to Ahaziah, you can attempt to consult this idol all you want. It's not going to make any difference. He's impotent. Instead, what's going to happen is what Elijah is going to announce to you. You're not recovering. Whatever your illness is, you're not getting over it. A death sentence has been pronounced upon you. So what happens? They didn't get very far, evidently, because verse 5 says the messengers came back. They returned to the king. And he said to them, why have you returned? In other words, we're not told how long this took, but kind of the impression you get is that he sends them, and you're like, an hour later, they get back, and he's like, what are you doing here? sent you on this, you know, this mission to Ekron to consult of this God. What are you doing back? And they said to him, there came a man to meet us and said to us, go back to the king who sent you and say to him, thus says Yahweh, is it because there is no God in Israel that you're going to inquire of Beelzebub, the God of Ekron? Therefore, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die. In other words, they're telling the king the exact thing that the messenger of Yahweh said for Elijah to say. So Elijah meets them, delivers this message. But at this point, they don't know who he is, evidently. So the king says, what kind of guy was this? What kind of man was he who came to meet you and told you these things? And they answered him, he wore a garment of hair with a belt of leather about his waist. And he said, and you could almost, I could almost hear the exasperation of this in his voice when he replies, it's Elijah the Tishbite. It's like, I knew it. I knew, because of course he knows who Elijah is. His dad has had to deal with him all these years. And so Ahaziah's response is the exact replica of the same kind of response that his dad used all the time when Elijah would meet him. You know, he was always frustrated because Elijah only spoke ill concerning him. And he's always, you know, he called him an enemy one time when he came up to Elijah. So Ahaziah is now caught in the exact same situation that his dad had been in.
Yeah, and this description of Elijah is important because you get this description of John the Baptist later.
Yeah. That's so if you ever wonder why John was dressed so weird, camel's hair by the belt around his waist, well, it was because he was, you know, Elijah version 2.0. He wasn't. And just to clarify, because you probably get asked this question on occasion too. I have it a number of times. And it was John the Baptist Elijah come back from the dead? You know, kind of a reincarnation of Elijah.
And not back from the dead, because you know Elijah doesn't die. But I think it's funny when people ask that question, because the answer is, if you really want to just like get weird with it, you just quote Jesus and say, if you're willing to accept it, he is Elijah. And this is how Jesus answers this question, which doesn't seem that helpful. You know, so when people, John the Baptist will say, I am not Elijah. Jesus will say, but if you're willing to accept it, he is. And like, so the answer to the question, is John Elijah, is no, but yes. And what that means is that, like, is he actually Elijah back for, you know, did God take Elijah into heaven, which we'll get there, and then send him back as John the Baptist? No. The answer to this is in the spirit of Elijah. So he is a prophet like Elijah. So before John arrives, and you can tell me if you agree with this, Chad, as far as I see it, so you have like the Mount of Transfiguration even. You have Jesus and Elijah and Moses, and Elijah is sort of considered the chief of all prophets. He is the prophet that God took to heaven. There's this, if nothing else, this sets him apart. So he's a different kind of guy. He might not have even been the prophet that did the most amazing things or said the most amazing things, but in the Jewish mind, it seems that he is a premier prophet because he is the prophet that they are waiting for to potentially return because he never died. They do this at the at Passover. And they say, maybe Elijah comes back, right? John is that. Is he actually Elijah back from heaven? No, but he is, as Jesus will say, now the greatest prophet that's ever lived. So in some ways, Elijah has been replaced in the hierarchy of prophets by John, who has come looking like Elijah, sometimes sounding like Elijah. And this is why Jesus says, if you're willing to accept this fact, that John is Elijah in the sense that he holds that position now of greatest prophet. I mean, Jesus will say greatest man who has ever lived.
Yeah. So you can almost say Elijah did die, but only when John died.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, he is a, so is he Elijah, you know, come down from heaven and, you know, reincarnated? No, but, as we read in Luke chapter 1, he comes in the spirit and power of Elijah. So is he Elijah? Yes, in that sense. He certainly is. You know, he is the one that Malachi spoke of. He's the one who would precede the coming of the Messiah.
And he has that that prophetic mantle of Elijah, where it says, like, I am the chief prophet now. Like, there's a new chief prophet has been established, and it's the most unlikely person ever out in the wilderness.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can't really understand the Old Testament Elijah apart from John, nor can you really understand John apart mm-hmm. from the Old Testament Elijah. You've got to look at these guys together if you really want to understand what their ministry was all about.
And I think
that's why John dresses the way that he does.
Yeah, and I think Jesus' words of, if you're willing to accept it, he is Elijah, is to say, that this is a difficult thing to understand, one, but two, that if you're willing to accept that this man that just seems like a nobody and a little bit wild is actually, and especially if you're speaking to a bunch of Jews, saying, this is the greatest prophet there's ever been, this seems like a tough thing to believe. And he's like, if you're willing to accept it, this is the new Elijah.
Yeah. This is the guy. And everything about his ministry pointed to that. Of course, obviously what he wore, but also where he was at, right? And we see this, we're going to see this in the next chapter in 2 Kings 2 when Elijah's taken up into heaven. But where does that take place? Well, it takes place at the Jordan. So, of course, that's where the ministry of John the Baptist has to take place as well. And one of the things that's associated real closely with Elijah, and we've seen this already in the Mount Carmel standoff, is fire. Mm-hmm. Fire falls from heaven, consumes, of course, the sacrifices, the wood, the water, everything. And we'll see in just a few more verses that once more Elijah calls down fire from heaven, and then he's taken up in the chariot of fire. So you can't really think about Elijah the prophet apart from fire in his ministry. He had a fiery ministry, we might say. And then, of course, that same language is echoed by John the Baptist as well when he talks about fire in his messages.
I think even the stuff that John says, where what is Elijah constantly doing? Like, everything in the worship practices of Israel are all crooked, right? Mm-hmm. Everything is crooked, and Elijah is attempting to straighten things out, right? To put things back in order. And this is the same kind of thing that John says he comes to do. He says that the Messiah, he's saying that the promised one is about to arrive, and that he is there to make straight the path. Right, so everything is also crooked. Like, the religious system, it's different than in Elijah's day, but it's just as crooked. It's everything is out of sorts, and John is there to try to make the path straight for the arrival of the Messiah.
And this just occurred to me. I had never made this connection before, and I thought before about how, of course, Elijah has his confrontations with Ahab, and here with Ahab's son. Just like John the Baptist, of course, rebukes the king for his unlawful marriage. I'd thought of that connection before, but I had not thought of the fact that even more than Ahab being the adversary of Elijah is Jezebel.
Mm-hmm.
And then who ends up actually being responsible for the death of Elijah? It's not so much the king, it's the king's wife.
Yeah, I mean, Herod doesn't want to behead John.
Yeah,
this is not something he desires to do.
Yeah, but his wife is one who orchestrates that.
Yes.
So yet another connection between the two. So in other words, always read about Elijah with John in mind, and always read about John with Elijah.
I think you even see, not to just linger on this point, but whatever, it's our podcast. I think even like his Elijah's confrontation with sort of the false prophets and John the Baptist confrontation with the sort of false religious leaders of his day. I mean, do you hear the kind of words that John says? I mean, like, the Pharisees and the scribes come out to witness what he's doing, and of course they're not there to, let's see if we should accept this guy. As they're there to try to figure out what's going on and why all these people are going out to this freak out in the wilderness. And John is the kind of guy that says Elijah kind of things, where he just casts his eyes up there and says, you brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? This sort of yeah. thing. And John is at war with a religious system the same way that Elijah was at war with a religious system, and he's taking on the leaders of that system, and they don't like it. There's a lot. I mean, it's be hard to miss all the things that are mirrored between the two.
And that's helpful too, I think, for us to understand the idolatrous nature of the first century religious system. Mm-hmm. I mean, idolatry in the Old Testament is blatant. It's really easy for us to see. I mean, we see it here because
so little calves made out of gold. It's real easy.
Yeah, I mean, it's like it's obvious, blatant idolatry. You know, when you have a golden calf, or when you have the king sending messengers to inquire of this Philistine god. Well, of course, that's kind of idolatry. That's unmissable. It's a little bit more difficult, though, when you get into the first century, because, of course, you don't have Sadducees and Pharisees and scribes and all them setting up golden calves. You don't have the same kind of idolatry taking place in the first century.
But you have money changers in the temple.
Yeah, you can money change into the temple. But, I mean, the point is that the more subtle the idolatry is, doesn't in some way subtract from the seriousness of the idolatry.
No, because Pharisees
had obviously made tradition in all of their obsession with legalism. That was their god. That was their Beelzebub.
Yep.
In the first century.
Yeah, I mean, at the very least, what you have is Yahweh is not being represented by the people who are tasked with representing him. These religious leaders are not painting a clear picture of God for the people. And so they've erected something else in its place. This is what John comes to address, and then ultimately what Jesus comes to fully address and gets him killed. But this is the same thing that Elijah's doing. I think that you can say pretty safely that in Elijah's day, nor in John's day, is Yahweh represented or delivered to the people in an accurate way.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's all forms of idolatry. It's just some's more blatant, some are more subtle. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's the subtle ones that are always, I wouldn't say always, but often more dangerous.
Oh, it's so
not.
Well, we're the same
not
way.
Not as easily seen.
We're the same way. I mean, if somebody's a member of a different religion, it's easy for us to say, well, obviously, you know, okay, you're worshiping this other god. Like, okay, clearly you're not a Christian, because you wouldn't even claim to be. That's not even the Christian god. But it's the same now. Like, legalism is just as much idolatry, but it's way sneakier, because it looks like it pretends to be righteousness, it pretends to be holiness and all of these good things, but it still obstructs the path to God.
Yeah, it's almost like Satan was learning as he went along that the best way to disguise himself is as an angel of light.
Yes.
As the God of this world. So he was almost theologically evolving, as it were, to understand how best to deceive people.
Well, that makes sense.
It's a lot easier to deceive people in subtle ways than by setting up golden calves.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, the devil's not God, so he doesn't know all things. So I assume he learns.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So we find out he, it's Elijah the Tishbite. The king says that. So the king decides, we're at verse 9. The king decides that he's going to just kind of, you know, he's going to take care of the situation. He's just basically going to arrest Elijah. I'm sure that's going to turn out well for him. It's like he did not learn anything from his father. So he sends a captain with 50 guys. So here's this military leader. He's got his 50 guys. They go up to Elijah. He's sitting on top of a hill. This could also be translated as mountain. Har is the kind of general word for hills or for mountains. So he's on the top. He's almost kind of picture this as sort of a Moses moment, right? He's up on his hill, or he's up on his mountain. He's way up high, so they have to go up to him. They go up and they say,
"This feels like just such a weirdo." Like, this reads like they get. Think about this scenario. He gets this word from Elijah, and in my mind, he's like, "Oh yeah, well, if I'm gonna die, guess who else is gonna die? I'm not going out alone. I'm gonna take this guy out with me. Take 50 guys. That seems like a lot of guys for one guy. Take 50 dudes and go find him. And where is Elijah? He's just like sitting Indian style up on a hill or something.
That's exactly the picture I had in my head. He's just like,
just waiting. He's
just waiting. Waiting for somebody to show. He knows they're coming. He's just waiting there.
Not hiding. He's just chilling up on top of this hill.
Yeah. I mean, he at least didn't run away this time, right? Like he ran to Sinai that time. He's just sitting there. And they say to him, "Oh, man of God, the king says, come down." But Elijah answered the captain of 50, "If I am a man of God," this is so brutal. "If I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And no surprise, fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. Play on words, by the way, here in the Hebrew. If I am an Ish of God, let Ash come down from heaven and consume you. So Ish is man, fire is Ash. So if I am that, you call me a man of God? Well, if I am a man of God, let me show you what a man of God can do. And then it's Mount Carmel all over again, except this time the fire falls and consumes the guys who came to arrest him, not an altar.
Well, I know this. Now you're about to get the definition of insanity.
That's precisely what I was thinking this morning when I was going over this. This is insanity. Let's keep repeating the same thing and see if we get different results. Verse 11, again, the king sent to him another captain of 50 men with his 50. How'd you like to be this captain? King calls you, "Hey, I got a job for you. You know that that first guy I sent out with his 50 guys? Well, they got burned up. Elijah barbecued them. So I want you to go and do the exact same thing." Well, this guy, he's a man who follows orders. He does that. He answered, said to him, "Oh, man of God, this is the king's order. Come down quickly." Even as an adverb, right? The other guy just said, "Come down." This guy says, "Come down and make haste about it." Elijah says the same thing. "Well, if I am a man of God, let fire come down from heaven and consume you and your 50. And it did. Fire came down from heaven and consumed him and his 50. So now we have 102 dead guys, all killed by fire from heaven.
I feel like the second guy added this one part too, where he says this is the king's order. The initial guy says, "The king says, come down." This guy comes up and says, "Listen, this is the king's order. I got nothing to do with this. You need to come down quickly."
Yeah. He was changing things up a little bit, hoping for better results. It didn't happen. Now we have a third guy. Robert Alter in his translation and commentary points out this is often a pattern you've seen in literature where A and B will happen, pretty much the same thing, and it's the third thing that differs. So you'll have two similar scenarios right after one another, and then the third is where things diverge. That's what happens here. So again, the king sent a captain of another 50 guys. Now this guy is smart. He's seen what happens. He's learning from other people's mistakes. And so when he comes up, first thing he does, on his knees, falls on his knees before Elijah and doesn't say anything like, "Hey, this is the king's orders," or barking commands. He entreated him and said, "Oh, man of God, please let my life and the life of these 50 servants of yours be precious in your sight. Behold, fire came down from heaven and consumed the two former captains of 50 men with their 50s. Now let my life be precious in your sight."
Yeah, this is a
he even went the whole passive route. He didn't say, "Behold, you cast fire down from heaven." He's just like, "Fire came down from heaven and killed these other guys. Please be gracious." And it was a smart move, because then Jesus shows up again. The messenger of Yahweh says to Elijah, "Go down with him. Don't be afraid of him." So Elijah did. He got up, he went down with him to the king. And all this loss of life, all of this delay, and nothing whatsoever changed. Because when Elijah got to the king, here's what he said. "Thus says Yahweh, because you have sent messengers to inquire of Beelzebub, the god of Ekron, is it because there is no God in Israel to inquire of his word? Therefore, you shall not come down from the bed to which you have gone up, but you shall surely die."
You know, the implication here is that he might not have died if he had just asked Yahweh. I mean,
this is what it said.
Like, I don't know. I don't know for sure what was going to happen, but I know for sure what's going to happen now.
Yeah, we've seen this multiple times where people are given a chance to change, to inquire of the Lord, to repent, and yet most of the time they steadfastly refuse to do that. So verse 17 says that he died according to the word of the Lord that Elijah had spoken. And then his brother, Jehoram, became king in his place in the second year of Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. Now, here's where we get confusing, because at least for a time, we got a king in the north and a king in the south, same name. So Jehoram, the other son of Ahab, the brother of Ahaziah, who just died, he's going to be the king in the north, but there's also going to be a son of Jehoshaphat in the south, whose name is also Jehoram. But anyway, his brother takes over because Ahaziah had no son. So he doesn't have an heir. And so instead of it passing to somebody else, it passes to his brother. And then we're told the rest of the acts of Ahaziah that he did. Are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel? And that takes us through the end of 2 Kings chapter 1.
That's it, man. And we are out of time, but we did manage to get through one chapter with a long, you know, bunny trail. Not really bunny trail, because it's there. The connections are there, but we're connecting some John the Baptist dots, but which was fun. All right, man. Next week, we will get into why people might think John the Baptist would be Elijah, because Elijah is going to do something that very few people do, and that's escape death.
Yeah, it's going to be a fun chapter for sure.
Yeah, so we will cover that next week. Chad, I'll see you then.
All right, see you then.